In 1998, Alan Burson became one of the nation's best-known non-traditional superintendents as this former U.S. district attorney took over the San Diego Public Schools. He immediately recruited Tony Alvarado, a well-known and well-respected New York educator, to turn around the district's approach to teaching and learning, an effort that foreshadowed many of today's struggles as schools work to implement the new Common Core standards. But by 2005, Burson was out, despised by the teachers' union and devoid of political support. In his new book, Tilting at Windmills, veteran journalist Richard Colvin provides the definitive account of Burson's San Diego years, and thanks to hours of interviews of Burson's thinking as he led California's second largest school district. Today, we talk with Colvin about Burson, San Diego, and the future of urban school reform. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you, Michael.
It's great to have you here in studio. Richard, tell us, first of all, about the idea for this book. Why Alan Burson? Why San Diego?
So it's interesting. In 2000, I spent a year at the University of Michigan, and I took a course with a couple professors there, and they cited San Diego as an example of a district that was putting all of its effort, putting a major, sophisticated, complex effort into improving teaching and learning. And here I was a Los Angeles Times reporter. I was covering national education issues. I was hardly 2 hours up the freeway, and I knew very little about this, and I was shocked. I knew that there was a lot of controversy there and a lot of people were pushing back on Alan Burson, but I didn't know the substance of it. And over the years, I looked at it, met Alan later on, and proposed the book to him, and he was more than willing.
Is it fair to say that you and Alan are friends?
We've become friends in the course of this. I admire the man greatly. I admire his values, and I admire how incredibly hard he worked on behalf of the school kids and schools in San Diego.
Now, as an author, was this a challenge then? I mean, so you know him, you like him. I mean, how do you make sure then you're not too uncritical of his work?
Well, fortunately, Alan's the kind of guy who is self-critical, and in over the years, he commissioned a number of researchers to come into San Diego and take a very critical look. In fact, from the very first months he was in office, he tapped a University of California San Diego researcher, gave him all the data for all the years that he was there, and subsequently there were some reports that were both good and bad, and he brought in a national group of researchers in 2005 to look at everything they'd been doing. So I had confidence that Alan would see this as an opportunity to be really frank, and in some cases I pushed him, and I wrote some things that he wasn't completely comfortable with.
Okay. All right. Well, let's dive in. So before he took over in San Diego as a superintendent, what had Alan Burson done with his life?
Alan is not a big guy, but he had been a all-conference, all-Ivy, all-star for the Harvard football team. He had been an Oxford scholar there with a Rhodes Scholar in Oxford with Bill Clinton. He'd gone to law school with Hillary Clinton. He'd been a corporate lawyer. He had been deeply involved in politics, and he had been the U.S. attorney on the border. A post during that time that he was in that post, he was named border czar by the Clinton administration to shut down the flow of drugs and illegal immigration across the border.
Pretty impressive resume.
That's right. It was an impressive resume. But, you know, your achievements outside of education, suddenly they don't count when you go into education.
Yeah, well, as we're learning from Paul Vallis's experience right now, what was happening in San Diego before Alan came in?
So San Diego, a couple years earlier, had been through a disastrous strike. It was a strike that the, you know, teachers won hands down. Not only did they win their economic goals, but they won broad powers to have a majority of the seats on school councils that would make most of the decisions. They really undermined the ability of principals to run schools. And because the district had been so defeated, the union had you know, tremendous power. And even though they were trying to cooperate, and the superintendent at the time was trying to cooperate with the union, almost nothing was happening. The key thing was then that the business community got involved, because they were afraid that they just weren't getting the kind of employees, that the kind of graduates they could employ. And so they got involved. And when it came, it was the board was so divided that they set up a system that took them out of the picture in terms of choosing the new superintendent. They voted four different times to uphold a process by which they would essentially turn over all of the process of finding a good candidate to outside entities. And then that process was designed to produce one candidate, and that was Alan Burson. And even then, it was contentious with a very divided board.
So whose idea was it to hire this border czar? I mean, was this Alan? Did he take initiative here, or did the board come after him?
Well, Alan was ready to move on, to be honest, from that job. He, you know, we don't need to go into the complicated Justice Department politics at the time, but he was up for a very high-level job in Washington, and because of some political stuff, it didn't happen. But he was restless. He was ready to move on. And they sought him out. One of the top business leaders in the city, who Alan did not know, reached out to him and said, you know, we might be interested in a non-traditional superintendent, because we need to shake things up. And all the candidates that we've come across, they're not going to be the people who shake things up. And so we need somebody who can do that. He had to be convinced, but in the end, he thought it was a good use of his time. He's a very public-spirited guy, and he thought he could make a difference.
And so he's non-traditional, and so that's a kind of a strike against him, according to many educators. But, you know, otherwise, he seems like a real Boy Scout. I mean, here he is, Harvard-educated, good bona fides in the Democratic Party. You know, did that help him? Did that go a long way? Did people give him kind of the benefit of the doubt?
Well, that's a good question. It did outside of San Diego. People were interested in what was this really accomplished guy, you know, Rhodes Scholar, Harvard, corporate lawyer, successful on the border. He did a very good job of reducing drugs and illegal immigration, and even cleaned up that office. People wanted to know about that. But inside the district, he had a bunch of strikes against him right from the start. Number one, the Latino community, at least the activists in the Latino community, blamed him for a crackdown on illegal immigration. And that had an unfortunate side effect, there's no doubt about it, because it forced some of the immigration eastward into the desert, and there was a big downside from that, obviously, and there were casualties. So they painted him as anti-Latino. Because of the process that the board set up, the head of the teachers union in San Diego was not on the inner circle and able to influence the process. He declared whatever candidate that the school board would identify illegitimate from even before meeting Alan. No matter who they chose, this person was going to be all out to make sure that they didn't succeed. And then finally,
That's a real sign of things to come,
that's
right?
That's a sign of things to come. Foreshadowing, as it were.
Yes.
And then finally, you know, the school board, all Democrats, you pointed out that Alan was very active in the Democratic Party, helped elect Clinton. All Democrats on the board, they were very divided. And, you know, some were very much aligned with the unions, and some were aligned with the ethnic politics. And so, you know, on all of those scores, Alan had some hurdles to overcome.
So he comes in this burst of energy. Even before taking over, he goes around the country. He tries to learn everything he can from success stories. He's boning up on education. And he comes to the conclusion, this radical conclusion, that the focus should be on teaching and learning. And you write about how unusual this is.
That's right. I mean, you know, this is the kind of person that today is castigated, corrugated for being a business guy. And he understood that the key part of school districts is teaching and learning. He also understood that he was not an expert in this area. So he sought out the person who had, at the time, was going all over the country as kind of a profit of how do you invest in professional development? How do you redirect resources in a way that really supports teachers? And not only that, but a person who in New York City, we're talking about Tony Alvarado here, a person who in New York City had tremendous support for the from the union because he had worked collaboratively with them and invested in the professionalism of the ranks. And so you would think that he did all the right things. He identified teaching and learning, and he brought in a top person who was widely respected, not only among school districts, he had won an award from the United Federation of Teachers in New York for his tremendous ability to collaborate with unions.
So tell us more about Tony Alvarado. What was he doing in New York that was so special and so successful?
So what Tony did was he identified, as he later would in San Diego, the fact that, as much research shows, as we know, teachers are the biggest factor in student achievement. So how do you improve that? And so he was the first to kind of create this new role of a coach, an instructional coach who was a teacher who would work closely and collaboratively with the instructors in a professional way to improve their practice. He also created something that is also now widely known and utilized, the idea that a principal needs to be the instructional leader in a building, and that the principal needs to be able to go through and look at a classroom and be able to, you know, make some important constructive commentary on the teacher's practice. It's known as variously, but the main name that it goes under is a learning walk. You need to be able to go through and watch somebody practice and be able to make some comments on how, you know, that are helpful. So coaching, learning walks, and the final thing that he did was he redirected a lot of resources, a lot of money, reduced the central office in the district that he was in New York City, devoted those resources out into the schools to help teachers and support them.
Now, it should be said that the district he was leading in New York City was fairly small and was also just elementary and middle schools.
This is correct. And so when the opportunity came along for Tony to try his ideas at scale in the nation's seventh largest school district, that included high schools, as you point out, he jumped at the chance. Now, interestingly, a little bit of backstory, Tony was a candidate for the superintendency in San Diego. He wasn't selected because he was seen as kind of a traditional guy. But also, he was at a point in his career, and I don't know if you know Tony, but he can be kind of abrasive to people. He's very confident in what he says about education. He was at a point in his career that he just didn't want to do the politics that you have to do as a superintendent. And so here's an opportunity. Alan gave him the opportunity to say, look, I'll take care of the politics, you take care of the teaching and learning, and give these ideas a good shot, try to implement them at scale in a large school district.
And again, sounds like a no-brainer. And it sounds like this should be popular with teachers to say, you know what, no, we're not going to focus on this Mickey Mouse stuff. We're going to focus on teaching and learning.
That's correct. So back to what I said about the context in San Diego. The president of the teachers union at the time had won what he believed to be the biggest victory of his life in that settlement, because it gave teachers so much control over the professional development in their schools. And so here was a guy, Tony and a pair, Tony and Alan, who came in and said, you know what, we want to have one approach to teaching reading. We want to have one approach to teaching math, and we're going to do it district wide, and we're going to support it and help teachers achieve it. So that was seen as this top down, my way or the highway kind of approach. Just the fact that they had the temerity to not let every single school go in its own way, caused some pushback. So,
but it should be said, Richard, that at the time, this is the late 90s, a lot of us reformers were also calling for so-called decentralization. The charter school movement was growing rapidly, and we said, districts should treat their schools like charter schools, and they should empower principals and leave them alone. This belief that these big central offices were the problem, not the solution. And so all these ideas around managed instruction and the like, that this was just more bureaucratic rigmarole that we need to cut. So how did Alan think about these issues? I mean, he kind of liked some of these decentralization ideas too, right?
He did. He liked them, as it turned out, more than Tony did. And there developed a tension because Alan's view, you know, remember, he's new to this whole world of education, and he's very in the sway of Tony Alvarado, who believes in managed instruction. And over time, a gulf developed between the two of them because Alan's view was, you know, once we teach the teachers, prepare the teachers, get them to understand what it is we're trying to get to, they needed to have greater freedom, and they needed to remember he was a lawyer, and he had this sense of professionalism that there's a body of knowledge that every professional ought to have, techniques every professional ought to have, but then you apply the generalities to the specific circumstance. Mm-hmm. And so that's professional judgment. And
right.
So his view was that after a period of time, teachers and principals ought to be given greater latitude to exercise that professional judgment. Tony believed they weren't ready yet, and that he had to really tightly manage almost everything they did. So a tension developed between Alan and Tony, and eventually Tony went his way. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's step a few steps back first. One of the first things that they did was to bring in these literacy coaches. So again, an innovation from New York, bringing it to San Diego. They're going to help teachers improve the craft of teaching reading. How did that go?
Well, again, I keep referring back to this contract, which gave teachers great sway and decision-making power at the local school. In that contract was the provision that they got to decide on their own professional development. And also in that contract was a position that designated a person. It went by different names. A peer supporter kind of person, mm-hmm. who would work with the teachers. So in that sense, they both the union and Alan and Tony knew that there needed to be this support position. The problem lay in the fact that the union wanted that person to be chosen by seniority. That it didn't matter whether that person had skill working with adults. It didn't matter whether that person understood the approach to literacy that Tony brought with him and that Alan endorsed. It didn't matter. All that mattered was whether that person was popular with the local teachers at a particular school and had seniority and could claim that job. That's the traditional way we do things in schools,
wow.
is that seniority matters.
And this is, by the way, at a time when it sounded like 100 different reading programs in the district. I mean, one, you know, kindergarten teacher teaching phonics and the first grade teacher teaching by sight. I mean, you know, totally all over the place.
Yeah, Tony counted up 146 different approaches to literacy in the schools, some, as you say, sometime within the same building. And you know, Alan's view was, look, literacy coaches only make sense if these people understand literacy,
mm-hmm.
and if they, you know, have shown some facility for working with their colleagues. That's mm-hmm. not a skill that everybody has. You know, even if you can teach kids, it doesn't mean you can teach adults.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a battle. This was a battle royale. This battle went on for 8 months, mm-hmm. in which Alan was making the argument, these people have to know something. And the union was saying, that's a power play by the district to say that these people have to know something. It was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. And who won the battle?
Well, neither one did, to be honest. Alan said, look, we need to get this going. I'm going to appoint these people. We already have a position in the contract that I can do that by. And the union pushed back, and there was so much political heat that Alan agreed. After many, many, many compromises, at the one point, he said, look, you fail the, you know, the training program, you don't succeed, you get another chance. Do the training program again. You don't feel the training program again, you go to a jury, and they get to decide whether you get to be a coach. But if they, you know, if they don't endorse you, then you get one more appeal. So there were like four different times that you could go through and still be chosen, even if you had failed. And that wasn't enough. And so finally, he took it to an outside arbitrator. They kind of split the difference. And in the end, there were literacy coaches.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't necessarily the people that would be best at that. Some were. And even then, the union had so soured the waters that at many schools, and it depended on the school and the leadership and the culture there, at many schools, the teachers still had the ability to not listen to anything the coach said to say. They didn't even have to let them in their room. And so the effectiveness of that approach, which had been so successful in New York, was really undermined.
And the argument from the union, as you write about, was saying, look, all this talk about having principals come in and walk through the rooms and to watch lessons or to have these coaches, it undermines the teacher as the instructional leader. That their position was the classroom teacher was the only appropriate person to be making instructional decisions.
That's correct. And and so there are all these extraordinary memos from the head of the teachers' union basically saying, we are the only experts. Anybody in the district has lost all credibility. They don't know anything about teaching. They don't know about our students. Our students are different. So you have to give it up to teachers and let them make any decisions they want.
Let them close the door and do what they want.
Close the door and do what they want. Now, again, you know, Alan, neither Alan nor Tony really wanted to script everything, but they wanted people to start from the same starting point in their instruction. And they wanted them to be influenced by people who were well prepared in this particular approach. And I'll never forget, there's this one memo that the president of the union wrote saying, you know, we as teachers, we know so much. We know when a kid has to go to the bathroom. We know how to, you know, whether an attendance excuse has been forged. We know how to make kids line up. It went on and on. We know how to supervise the playground. It went on and on. Never mentioned anything about we as professional teachers understand the needs of our students, and we're able to prescribe approaches that are going to be helpful to them. Never
and help them learn.
Instruction at all.
Let's step back a minute here and talk about what this all means for what many schools are going through, almost all schools in 45 states at least, implementing the Common Core, you know, which certainly pushes back on this idea that teachers should be able to just close the door and do whatever they want. How should districts be going about this? Is there some kind of teacher buy-in that Alan did not get that's going to be essential here?
Oh, I think absolutely, and I think that's one of the lessons that Alan would endorse, that it doesn't matter your political circumstances. If you can't get the teachers, and eventually he did get a lot of teachers, ones that he had hired, but if you can't get the teachers, and even the union, to endorse this idea that teachers need a lot of professional support and guidance in carrying out a particular instructional regime, you're never going to make any progress. So in terms of the Common Core, I think it's really interesting. This is a set of standards, not a curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think, despite the critics, that the Common Core gives teachers tremendous ability to make professional decisions about how to teach to these standards, which are not so specific and detailed as existing standards. It's not being played that way, as you know, but it gets set up as an opportunity to do the kind of coaching, the kind of support. The other point that's relevant today, of course, is that we have these more robust evaluation systems of teachers, effectiveness systems. Some people prefer, as because evaluation is not a term that they like, but. That is going to involve coaching. That is going to involve, right? I mean, there's observations of people who know a lot about it, teaching instruction, who come in and give you some feedback. That seems like something teachers would like, but our experience in San Diego, as you know, is that it has to be managed very, very carefully to make sure that the feedback is not seen as criticism or as part of the evaluation.
Right. And the suspicion of teachers towards the central office in many places is well-founded. I mean, it's not untrue that many central office people don't know what they're talking about when it comes to teaching and learning.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, San Diego, in a lot of ways, was very, very top-down before Alan got there. But they were top-down about how you spend every single penny, crossing the T's, dotting the I's. You know, there were so many regulations, so many different funding streams that you had to adhere to. but the whole system was not geared around supporting and teaching and learning. So I think, you know, teachers and their professional organizations really can push hard to say, you know, we expect a central office to be supportive of what we do and helpful to what we do, and not just nitpick us and pick us and make us fill out forms and, you know, not focus all of our attention on the needs of students.
All right, so let's talk about Alan's relationship with the principals, who he wanted to be instructional leaders. At the end of his first year, he fired 13 principals and 2 vice principals. Let me ask again, how'd that go?
It did not go well. And part of it was like what we in Washington always call the optics. The first announcement of this actually was in a crawler across the bottom of the local news stations, saying 13 principals had been fired. And it wasn't because they had, you know, committed any crimes or that they had stolen money or anything like that. It was because they weren't, essentially, they were resisting everything from the central office. They weren't getting on board with this approach to teaching and learning. They had resisted all efforts to bring them along. And so they were fired, and it was really, really badly handled. First of all, the way it was announced was bad. Mm-hmm. Secondly, Alan, being an attorney, you know, relying on the advice of his attorney, decided that they had to be moved out of their offices by the end of the day. Just pick up everything you own and get out and turn in your keys and you're gone.
And there's going to be a police officer watching you.
And there was a security guard watching to make sure that you didn't take anything, you know, that wasn't yours, and to make sure you went out and you didn't try to stir up discontent on your way out the door. Mm-hmm. It was not good. And Alan, you know, in retrospect, realized that it was a huge mistake, because it had really, you know, that occurred at the end of his first year. So for almost exactly a year, he had been arguing that principals were the key levers by which you would make instructional change. And he was meeting with them every month and talking about professionalism and giving them readings and, you know, bringing in some of the top experts to meet with them. And so this kind of, you know, they were treated like they were,
criminals.
Malefactors, and shoved out the door. He realized later that was a huge mistake.
That was the end of the honeymoon period, I guess.
End of the honeymoon period. But, you know, I just want to say that over the course of 7 years, Alan built tremendous support among the principals. He started what is still widely regarded as a very effective leadership preparation program, one of these clinical programs that people are working in the schools as they are getting the formal training. He gave them tremendous support. He recognized them every month. He really treated them as professionals, and I think over time, you know, admittedly, over 7 years, he had hired most of the principals that were there in a very rigorous hiring process, and they were devoted to him.
Yeah. And what was his approach to turning them into these instructional leaders?
So the first step in that actually was in the hiring process. In a lot of urban school districts, at least it used to be when I was covering urban schools, the only thing you really had to do was to have an administrator certificate and be in the camp of one of the school board members and you could get a job. And, you know, typically you also had to meet the criteria that there was a racial balance and a language balance in most urban districts, and so certain principalships would be designated as a black seat or a Latino seat or a white seat. He turned that on its head, and principals had to come in. They had to do these learning walks, and they had to show that they really knew their stuff instructionally. And they had to talk about instruction and their philosophy about instruction. So at the very front end, they had to demonstrate that they had the capacity to be instructional leaders. Secondly, they were evaluated based on whether or not their teachers were showing improvement, not mastering necessarily, because everybody's on a different point in that learning curve, but showing improvement, moving along in terms of their ability to teach this approach to literacy that really engaged students and got them thinking and all that sort of stuff, as well as other subject. And in fact, we can talk about that later, but the idea that you would take this same kind of essentially a progressive approach to instruction and put it all across all 12 grades was somewhat problematic. But you had to show that you understood that, and you were evaluated on whether your teachers were improving in that regard. And then thirdly, you met every single month with your, he created these positions called instructional superintendents. And they were not area superintendents. They were people who were the very best instructional people. And they were providing monthly, day-long instructional sessions for the principals. And then there were meetings once a month with Tony and with Alan, and talking about where the district was at and where they needed to be paying attention and how things were moving. So they were treated with as professionals, and there were high expectations for them.
So after many years of this centralized approach to school reform, managed instruction, and the like, finally, towards the end of his tenure, Alan Burson gets interested in charter schools. How come, and what did he do about it?
Well, actually, Alan was interested in charter schools from the beginning. In the very beginning, when he was superintendent, there were a few charter schools that had been getting, you know, knocked around and delays and delays, and came to Alan and said, you know, we want some help here, and he pushed them forward. One of them was, and is, maybe one of the preeminent charter schools in the nation, High Tech High. They were having a hard time getting through until Alan pushed for it and said, this is ridiculous. It's a good group of educators. They've got a strong plan. Let's get it done. And then there were a couple others, the Price School, which was the University of California, San Diego. Again, very strong leadership. So he advocated for them. As time went on, you know, in California, the charter school movement was proliferating pretty quickly. San Diego actually got dinged by the state for not doing a good enough job of making sure charter schools were good in their geographic area. And so Alan said, well, let's open up a charter school office. The school board and the administration, the bureaucracy of the district said, well, let's make it really regulatory. Let's make their orientation. We're going to regulate. And Alan's view was, well, no, let's not do that. Contra to the idea that charters ought to have some independent operating room. But what he did say was, let's develop a policy by which we're going to use to judge charter school applications, but also we're going to support charter schools. I mean, if they're good for kids, they're good for kids. And so he did that. And again, there was tremendous pushback within the district, within the bureaucracy. But he set up one of the first charter school offices in the nation under a remarkable guy. So charter schools began to proliferate in the district.
So tell me how this story ends. He's successful. They throw a parade for him. Is this everybody thanks him for his public service?
Well, it didn't work out that way, Michael.
Okay. That was an easy question, Richard. That was an easy question.
I didn't even have to think about that. So it's really interesting. The union's opposition was really losing steam. The last vote for the president of the union during Alan's term, there was like very, very low turnout among unions and among members. And you would think if they were all sort of motivated to get rid of this guy, they would bring in somebody who could be a really strong advocate. There just wasn't that much interest. New teachers had been hired, and they had been, as one teacher says in the book, you know, this is the milk that we were weaned on. We understood this approach, and we thought we were being well supported. Principals were ones that he had hired. He had built external support. You know, it's interesting, he never had a strike during those 7 years, in part because all the other unions were fine with what he was doing. And so you take, for example, the labor council for the county. These are the unions that represent working class people. They were not upset with Alan at all, and they put pressure on the teachers union not to strike, not to push back. So he was actually building support, and he believes, and I think the evidence suggests, that they had really turned a corner and they were really going to do great things. Tony had moved on, in part because of this dispute over how much freedom to give the schools. Alan had realized that their approach to high schools was not working. You couldn't have a unified approach to high schools that served very different communities and very different neighborhoods. So he set up this tiered approach, which, you know, subsequently a lot of school districts have followed, of low-performing high schools had a certain amount of latitude and autonomy, and then, you know, it changed based on their needs and success. Mm-hmm. But, you know, high schools, different topic, but high schools, at least after the end of the 7 years, had not been successful. So he was actually building, he was addressing all the issues, he was building political support, but, you know, we often say that school districts ought to be part of the political fabric of a whole community, and that the politics of school districts shouldn't be shut off from the community politics, mayoral politics, and so forth. In this case, it was a real problem because, I don't know if you remember, but the city had this huge, huge problem with fraud around their pension, and they were going bankrupt, and their people went to jail around that. And there was so much dissatisfaction around the things that were happening municipally that in the election in fall of 2004, every incumbent, all the school board incumbents, every city council incumbent, was thrown out. And Allen's and the board kind of, you know, all of his supporters got wiped out in that onslaught against incumbency. And the new board, many of them had campaigned on one issue: let's get rid of Alan Burson.
Wow.
And the same week that election occurred, the rabble-rousing columnist for one of the free weeklies that had attacked Alan relentlessly throughout his 7 years, basically the headline was, "We win," because they knew that Alan's time was short. And again, right after that, the teachers union began running ads saying, okay, you're in office, it's now time to get rid of Alan Burson.
So you finished the book with a chapter about lessons for urban school reform. And tell me if I'm reading this right, it seems like you say, and Alan is saying, that in the end, you got to pay a lot of attention to power and politics, which is kind of ironic since he started off with this very strong focus on teaching and learning.
That's absolutely right, Mike. You know, you can push through an idea about teaching and learning as hard as you want, but you've got to have internal support, you've got to have the support of parents, and you have to have external support. You have to have the broader public, the broader political environment being supportive of what you're doing, because only then can you weather the bumps in the road. You know, Alan had a very kind of, I don't know, difficult relationship with the union, but he also had kind of an intellectual and emotional, struggling for the word, kind of a, he had an internal struggle about how he felt about the union. His family were Roosevelt Democrats going way back. Mm-hmm. He was a strong union supporter. When Albert Shanker started the strike in New York, he didn't go to school because, in support of the teachers. And so he had this very strong bias towards the importance of unions as a way of developing the middle class and employee rights and so forth. He had a very difficult time with the unions, but ultimately he realized if you don't have the unions with you, you're just not going to make it. And he calls for a new kind of unionism, one in which the unions, you know, not just see their it benefits them to care about students, but that they really have kind of a professional union approach, and we don't have that right now.
But Richard, when you read this book and you say, okay, you had Alan Burson, Tony Alvarado, and two incredibly talented leaders, and they couldn't even do what it took to dramatically move the needle because of these power politics. Why not just give up on urban districts, right? People out there, Andy Smerick, Paul Hill, others saying, you know what? We really need to replace urban districts with something very different. Urban districts cannot be fixed. Is that where you're at after writing this book?
It's not. Alan had a lot going for him. He had his talent. He had Tony Alvarado's talent. He had the support of the business community. He had a huge amount of foundation money that was interested in seeing him succeed. So some of what happened in San Diego was unique to the situation. It was the nature of the contract that had been signed. It was the nature of the leadership in the union. It was the nature of the politics around the school board. But I think the lessons really are generalizable. You do have to move at the right pace. You know, you have to keep things moving forward, but you can't be mired in the idea that everybody has to agree before you can do anything. You have to build internal and external support. You got to do a lot of things right for urban education to work. But I do think that, you know, if we're going to care about all of our kids, and most of those kids in urban districts are disadvantaged and need a lot of help, you got to have somebody that's looking out for them. You got to have an entity whose goal is to serve their needs and who has the resources to bring to bear to serve their needs. I think there's plenty of room for alternatives, but I also think that the vast majority of our kids are going to continue to go to large urban school districts in our cities, and that they need to function as well as they possibly can. I actually think, and this may be going too far, but I actually think that the example of Alan in San Diego ultimately was a successful one that ought to be learned from. The post-game analysis that was done of Alan's record suggests that everything that they were doing around literacy and math, K through 8, is having not only immediate effects, but it's continuing to have effects. You know, the San Diego is a finalist this year for the Broad Prize. And some people would say, and the district, in fact, ironically, says Alan had nothing to do with this. But keep in mind that a vast majority of the teachers and the principals were ones that were hired under Alan Burson, and they continue to use the skills and the knowledge and the sensibilities that they developed under his leadership. So I think there is great hope. If there's any one lesson that you can take away from this, is that we have to be patient and you have to have sustained leadership. He was there for 7 years. If he had been there 3 more years, I think you would have seen an amazing, amazing accomplishment.
The book, again, is Tilting at Windmills: School Reform, San Diego, and America's Race to Renew Public Education. Richard Colvin, thank you so much for joining us on the Education Next Book Club.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's fun.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterin. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy, and I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.